Okay, it's on.
This will be on Thursday, July, no, about this, about August, 23rd. Planning committee meeting, can't speak to you this evening. Call the meeting to order. Are there any comments regarding the minutes from the last meeting? Do I hear a motion?
So moved.
Second, meeting minutes to the previous meeting approved. And are there any, I'm going to go to the public comment here. We have one, I think, yes. Is it non-agenda items?
I'm here this evening. Thank you for the opportunity to speak. Larry Costello, 13050 470th Avenue, North Bend. Just to stay abreast of the discussions concerning the scoping for the energy and sustainability chapter of the comprehensive plan. So I look forward to hearing the commission to discuss that. And if there's any opportunity to provide some input, I'd be happy to.
Great, thanks. I don't see any other members of the public hiding anywhere, so we're going to the next. Thanks again for the times, Mike. I appreciate that. Item number four is consideration of scope and remaining review of the energy and sustainability element.
We just wanted to have a chance to check back with you guys and think about the remainder of the time for your review of the energy and sustainability element. So we've conducted the public hearings that we were intending to conduct, at least that we originally set out to hold. And there was a few additional items that we weren't planning on holding public workshops on because there are just generally less controversial topics, or we had fewer policies on them, and we figured we'd just handle those through the Planning Commission process with additional meetings. And at the last meeting, there was some interest in holding an additional workshop for a speaker on another perspective on climate change. We wanted to check in back with you guys on that as well, and kind of in line with a reduced scope that we wanted to present. So one of the things that the original element, as presented to you guys back in October when we started this process, had some policies concerning climate change, greenhouse gas emissions monitoring and tracking. So what we were thinking we could do is get rid of those particular policies, because the state does not actually require local jurisdictions to monitor greenhouse gas reductions. All it requires is that we have policies that address reduction of greenhouse gases. And that's only for eligibility for those grants that we've talked about. So we were thinking we could get rid of the section that describes the requirement to do monitoring and tracking, thereby getting rid of the staff commitment to that, which is pretty heavy, and getting rid of, I guess, some of the debate over whether greenhouse gas emissions or climate change is anthropogenic. We don't want to get into that discussion at all. That's not something that affects North Bend and our particular policies. We want to be a little bit more pragmatic and just say we're focusing on energy, we're focusing on fossil fuel use and transportation patterns through our other policies within the element and through the transportation element of the comp plan, and leave it at that. So we wanted to check in with you guys and see if you concur with that, or if you do still want to see additional presentation on climate change.
I'll just draw a comment. I mean, I appreciated the presentation. It's, you know, it felt like I was back at school again for a little bit. And that's always good information, but even the professor acknowledged that was way over our scope. And the conversation level was out in the stratosphere relative to our city. Mm-hmm. And I could see that would lead into this grand debate that really is not for right here. So that's my two cents.
And we also felt that he did get a little bit political in some circumstances, which really wasn't appropriate.
Right.
He should have maintained objectivity and just left it with, this is what other scientists say, rather than inserting the political cartoons and things like that.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, we definitely do not feel that North Bend has the bandwidth, or, you know, we just don't have any reason to debate the source of climate change, rather deal with, like Mike said, the issues that at hand that we can actually implement within our city that can help us be more efficient economically and be better stewards of the environment, mm-hmm. or what have you. So we really, before we brought in new speakers that could maybe lead us down, not that a new speaker would, but to mm-hmm. continue a discussion that really we're not going to end up implementing into our, mm-hmm. we thought we wanted to reduce the scope, come bring it back to what we intended to do, and focus more on our policies.
So I'll go. I think Rob said it last time, Jim said it this time, and I agree that it's kind of out of the scope when we're talking about global climate change. And I came ready with questions about different types of roofing or asphalt streets, and that was something where he doesn't have the expertise. And so where I was thinking, you know, he suggested another speaker that would focus more on urban infrastructure and policies that might be applicable to what we're trying to do here. I don't know if it's really warranted now that I've done some research and thought about you know, some things that we might be able to do as a city or to help inform the residents. And I think one of the things I talked about at the last meeting, there was a slide that you showed the different sources, and transportation was the number one. I think residential was the second one. And I think it would be, something easy to do on our city website under community, just to add a link for home conservation and forward them to, you know, Puget Sound Energy,
yes.
or wherever
mm-hmm.
else, you know. So that could be just a proactive step that the city does. We're thinking about, we have 5,000 residents, we're going to grow, and how much we grow, and focusing on what we have as existing construction, but also on creating policies for better construction going forward, where we reduce the footprint of buildings or create more livable walking spaces that can use the bike trails. And so I know City of Issaquah is considering a new development standard for their commercial core. I've seen it in Redmond, where they're doing first floor business and three stories of residential. So something for our downtown commercial core that maybe we're going to look at to increase capacity and create a more livable, walkable city.
Yep.
I could see the thing that kind of popped in the radar for me is that whole conversation was going on, and almost every conversation we have. It seems prudent to pay attention that we're not making policy decisions based on a grant that's floating out there somewhere. So if you start spending our energy and our staff time and all these things that we're doing with an end in mind, and the end is just to get money. I know that's not really what's happening, but I think it's easy. It's an easy trap to get into, particularly when you start focusing on environmental kinds of things. And I'm just going to put that out there because this was probably the loudest conversation I've heard since getting on this commission that related to green, environmental, global warming, etc. And I'm reluctant to have us spend a lot of time getting to a place where the federal government's going to send us a check if we do something.
The sources of funding are very important to the city, though. The plaza that we just got, they had criteria just to look at, do we have policies addressing climate change? And we were able to point to some of those policies that we had in that draft ordinance.
But
you know, I even come back to, when you really look at all the different individuals that are talking about what is potentially impacting the climate change issue. Even if you take that out of the equation and you drill down into all of the potential issues that are out there, whether they're agreed upon throughout the political systems or scientists, it really comes down to living a pretty efficient lifestyle, and that always, in the end, saves economically and helps reduce impacts environmentally. So I think, you know, when it comes to, I think our policies in the end will do exactly what we need to do when it comes to going out and getting grants. If we're saying, hey, we're going to build 5 miles of road, we could build 5 miles of road and have 2 people live on it, or 5 miles of road and have X amount of people. And obviously, the economy as a scale is going to be more efficient in a number of different ways. And I think so, in the end, I think we'll be accomplishing that without having to truly debate some of the very, very highly debated issues worldwide. Because we're just not able to do that in this venue.
And it seems like if the city does things on its own that make people feel like they live in a community that's for these types of things, that encourages that type of behavior. Like, just a small example is like in the city of Kirkland, they have the trash cans down there that have the solar on top, and so it compacts, and they're picked up way less. And it's a very visual savings that it isn't probably that big of a deal, but I think you see it, and you're like, you live in this community, and I think it encourages people to practice those types of things. When you talk about measurements, can you remind me was it just measuring like city stuff, or are you trying to measure the residents?
Not the residents, but there's a whole range of scales of what you can consider in a greenhouse gas emissions inventory. The primary thing would be the city's own operations, so
right,
our wastewater treatment plant, our streetlights, our buildings. What's the source, or what's the emissions from that amount of energy use? Mm-hmm. You can expand that then to transportation, which is the next big sector. That gets very messy, though, in that people aren't just commuting within your own jurisdiction. They're going elsewhere and all over the place.
Right.
And I think the models take that into account, but North Bend's kind of at the very end of the cul-de-sac, so to speak.
Pronounce the best model in that.
Well, the other thing to keep in mind, too, is there's so many different processes that kind of overlap each other. SEPA is an example. So with SEPA, with new projects, SEPA it's now becoming standard that you include this evaluation through the SEPA process to try to minimize, if you're building a large building, the overall impacts of that building through an inventory similar to that. And so that's being done, even we're doing that
to help mitigate
impacts.
Do you guys have like a standard worksheet? I know like City of Seattle, there's just a worksheet that you can fill out and you kind of fall into different categories and then your emissions are kind of spit out the other end.
We've only had to use it once. Hi, Roger.
Straight to adjourn?
Yeah. All right, let's roll.
So, Mike, I'll just touch on it one more time. If I think about that chart that showed the main sources of the emissions, and if we have more priority to focus on what we can control and what is going to be the primary sources within our city, and we don't try and touch on any of the residential construction that's going to happen, I think it's a missed opportunity. I'd like to find out how we can even look at what we already have in policies and see where we fall with some of the built green standards and figure out then where that would be appropriate for those builders who want to come in and develop in that way.
I wasn't suggesting taking out the policies that encourage green building. I was just talking specifically to the requirement for what the policies called for with actually conducting a greenhouse gas emissions inventory and tracking it over time and so forth.
Other things, I know we just recently got a new trash contract in the city. I was behind a Republic trash truck the other day, and it was powered by natural gas, I want to say. So I don't know if, we can think about, I can't remember where you touched on contracts and some kind of evaluation where you're looking at if they're more environmentally friendly or not, if that might be part of that decision in the contract process that the city does business with. Because that certainly would be a good opportunity that's a recurring, 4 or 5 trucks per week. So.
Yeah, there were some policies in the environmental purchasing section that called for when all other criteria are equal and you're already meeting your intended usage or whatever it is, then consider whether or not they've reduced, added to recycling or whatever the criteria might be.
So then I have a question about what would the final copy look. So we had the Chapter 10 policies, but then there were specific code changes that you had proposed in some of the PowerPoints. Are you going to compile them into a single document, or how?
No, there's no code changes at this point. All we're proposing is the policies. And the policies almost exclusively were an incentive-based, develop incentives for X, Y, and Z, or to address the city's own operations. And so those incentives then would be something that we come back with some code amendments in the future to address.
Okay. And so we're going to have a public hearing, and what would that document look like? I'm just, so I know what work I want to do. You know,
yeah.
I'm just trying to copy.
Well, before we get to the public hearing, we want to bring this back for continued review by the Planning Commission. That will probably take a couple of meetings. We'll bring back a simplified document that we've scaled back some of the policies, getting rid of the section on greenhouse gas emissions inventory, and then move from there. Also addressing the sections that we didn't have a workshop on. So that was education and outreach, local economy, equity, and urban forestry. Through those policies.
And when it comes down to it, there's, you know, like Mike said, there'll be a couple of meetings. There's not a hurry to approve this. We're not mandated to have this chapter yet. It is something that's definitely strategic in getting grants, but it's better to take the time and make sure we cover our bases before we move forward.
So striking the balance, right? We don't want to back burner it. We want to keep it moving forward.
Yeah.
Okay.
Is there any more discussion on sustainability? So, moving on. 10 minutes early, according to the time clock here.
Good work.
Discussion over biological opinion amendments to move the district code. Planning Commission deliberation and possible recommendation.
Yes. Here we are again. So we've had a chance to look at the findings and we discussed this at our meeting 2 weeks ago, I guess it is, June 28th, and I revised the table, which is on larger pieces of paper, just to kind of better describe the change in the regulations. So we have biological opinion changes, and then we've also integrated some miscellaneous code edits in those chapters that we already have open. And I guess maybe first the miscellaneous code edits, a lot of them are corrections in terminology, taking out references to our moratorium, which is no longer in effect. We clarified what an eve is on a home, and that we require a minimum 18-inch eaves. And let's see here, and I know the page numbers are a bit hard to follow. In our bulk and dimensional standards, we passed out. No, I think that made it into the packet. We changed the rear yard setback in the DC zone. It was 25 or 30 feet across the board.
Which page are you referencing this?
It's in 1810. Where's the bat? 04. Let's see. It's 1810 040. That's the page that goes landscape, and it's 1875 is the bottom of the page. It's a little over halfway through, maybe.
Looks like this. And it has 1875 at the bottom.
So with the rear yard setback minimum in the D DC zone for single family, for duplexes, for triplexes, was either 25 or 30. And we're proposing to bring that down to 10. In the DC zone, even if it were a single family home going in, we allow commercial uses as well in that zone, so it didn't seem to make a whole lot of sense to have such a large rear yard setback.
Plus the lots are very, very small, that they allowed minimum lot size. So in theory, since we have our, we don't have a set to lot.
Yeah, there's really the front setback and the sides are zero, so.
Yeah.
So walk through a typical lot center. What happens? The property owner has been there under X guidelines and they're going to change. What's the impact?
Well, in this case, we're giving them more flexibility in their rear yard. So it could.
For an addition or
mm-hmm.
or demo and start over, they've got more mm-hmm. more footprint to work with.
Mm-hmm. Okay. And because we allow uses to go from residential to commercial, like you know, in these areas here, there wouldn't be as big of an impact some other way. So we're treating everybody kind of
so,
there.
So it's increasing your coverage, lot coverage. And the trade-off is because you're coming up, right, to get above flood?
No.
Not in context of any particular trade-off, just to provide more just flexibility.
Adding flexibility.
Flexibility and usability.
Well, we did increase the coverage.
So, which would, I guess, my first reaction is I kind of like it, but it seems to go counter to issues of flooding to have more lot coverage than less. So what am I...
No, this isn't necessarily a lot coverage thing. We've kept the lot coverage percent the same. So since we have a number of lots, and I think one happened on 6th, where the home was an existing home, and it was placed in the middle of a lot. An older lot.
Okay.
They wanted to add a bedroom on the back, if I recall. They couldn't because the rear setback was 30 feet. And then
gotcha. When
we were looking at 30 feet in what we consider our most densely populated core, it didn't seem to make sense. Okay. And then when you started thinking about that in the realm of other uses like commercial, although commercial has a different one, right, Jamie?
For rear.
Commercial's
okay.
Zero.
Okay, right. Yeah, so it hasn't changed. Coverage is just given flexibility to wear on the lot. Okay.
Again, just in the busy
right.
season.
Yep.
So, I'll go ahead and pass.
On that, though, there's 1810 bulk dimensional standards in this chart. It says, increased and new impervious surfaces shall not exceed 10% of the surface area proportion of the lot in the floodplain.
Mm-hmm.
So if we're increasing the footprint, how do they work together?
Well, they could be two separate things depending on the lot and if the lot's in the floodplain and subject to that. So yeah, the new, if you turn one page over, that's the reference under maximum impervious surface for lots within the floodplain. And then what you just read about the maximum impervious surface.
Page 3
of the chart.
Yeah.
So again, yeah, this is only applying in the floodplain, which is a lot of the downtown area. So the new code language, if the proposed project will create new impervious surfaces more than 10% in the floodplain, the applicant demonstrates an imminent increase in the rate and volume of stormwater surface that leaves the site, or that there's an adverse, or that the adverse impact is mitigated for the habitat mitigation assessment. And this language is from the BIOP. We already do this, essentially. Our stormwater regs already cover this. The trigger is new, that 10% trigger is new, but if it were 5% or 3%, we would require that stormwater runoff is leaving the site. So, some of these code changes that we're doing for the BIOP you know, we're doing them in an effort to show that, you know, our code meets what the biological opinion has asked it to meet. Some of them are a little strange or little nuances, but...
Does this also change anything with our Shoreline Master Program as far as access? If the building's built closer, there wouldn't be room for a trail then. So I don't know how that those would work together.
Well, when the application comes forward, we're balancing all the competing code provisions. So we would still, in theory, implement access in addition to X, Y, and Z. Without a scenario in hand, it's hard to...
That'd be all up to the design of that, right? So there could be mitigation that if there was a trail, you could allow them to go maybe closer to the neighboring lot line or something.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, potentially.
Or higher.
As long as it all falls within the provisions of a
variance. A lot of those BC lots along the river are the kind of long, skinnier ones. Mm-hmm. So.
Yeah, there's already a natural.
They're not going to use.
People in the 20s were smarter than getting credit.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. A couple of the other edits that didn't get into your packets. And then I guess we can go over
questions. That's before you get the stuff that's not in the packet?
Yeah.
What does the requirement that all eaves be 18-inch overhang gain? What's that do for you?
That's already in the code. And then it's just a question about what is the eave? Is it just the gable end? Is it just the soffit? So we put it in definition.
Definition of E, but I thought I saw, and I'm not, I moved away from the page. There was a change from certain locations to saying that it's all eaves. That is what I read. Maybe that was just a clarification that it did mean all eaves. And is that the essentially? Okay.
Mm-hmm. That's under performance standards 18.050. It just says all eaves shall be a minimum of 18 inches.
Okay.
And then we define what that is. Yeah. Are there other questions?
I've got one more on page 18-11 under 1806030. Or you've added language that says for properties within floodplains development. I assume the rest of the language was there before, but includes removal of more than 5% native vegetation.
Mm-hmm.
What's native vegetation gaining us over whatever vegetation might be on the site?
This is one of the requests for the biop. That's where this language comes from. At the last meeting, we talked about clarifying that, which is the highlighted area, so that 5% applying only to floodplain properties, and native vegetation just being more, you have a higher valued property or a function of the property based on a habitat assessment than if you had blackberries. So I think they're assuming that it's more detrimental to remove the native vegetation than invasives and what their benefit is. So
it's not saying so if your entire lot happens to be covered with invasive species.
Then you're going to remove them all. Yeah.
Right. Okay.
Yeah.
So the 5% is somebody else's way.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. And if I could, this was on one of my pages. That must have been labeled. I circled this. So I just picked up the way it was read. So in the highlighted area for properties within floodplains,
mm-hmm.
How about a floodplain?
Mm-hmm.
Legal mind says this is applying only to properties that are in multiple floodplains.
Mm-hmm. Floodplains. Very good.
Or we would just say within the floodplain.
The floodplain or a floodplain. Yeah, right. Agree.
I had a couple of comments that just as I read through this, I don't think it makes sense to go back and start with page
Yeah, we can, sure.
So the thing that occurred to me as I read through this, I want to throw it as a conversation, perhaps, maybe it's already been resolved. This whole document is just kind of an overlay of what we've done already. What impact would you say this has to the average citizen? Is it pretty much the same stuff said a different way, or are we really changing some things that are going to impact them?
I don't think we're changing. I don't think there's going to be a large impact. Our hope in doing this is that we're showing that our code meets the biological, and, you know, supports the biological opinion, and that the applicant and the city won't have to spend the time and resources. Because if we didn't do this, then every single application, like the hotel has had to do, has to do a biological assessment, which is a huge report, and it's basically a super big, super-sized critical area report. And so the language, a couple pages in, on the bottom of 14, is really kind of the meat of it all, is that a floodplain habitat assessment and mitigation plan may be required unless the city makes the determination of a no adverse effect on species listed under the Endangered Species Act. And since we don't have listed species up here, that should be pretty straightforward to show there is no impact. So I mean, in the future, it's a change. Stranded probably won't end up here. But
what's going on in the footnoting that we end up with 14 in the bottom of every page?
It's from the code. These are just
That's referencing Title 14.
Yeah, Title 14. Up at the top is really the.
In the end, what because we're above the falls, what's nice is even if we end up having to do a habitat assessment just to ensure that we've met FEMA's requirements, like the hotel has done, it's basically water quality related, so it's stormwater related, which in the end, what we're doing is beefing up any question in our code so we can say, hey, our code actually will ensure that we meet all these.
And critical areas are not going away. So if you have critical areas, you're still going to have to do a critical area, report it, and show no net loss of impact. That's going to address it too. So hopefully we're making life easier for everybody by showing our code is with these changes, with these kind of minor changes that we're in compliance and you have nothing to worry about if you meet the code. So
if you don't drink the bad whiskey, you've got nothing to worry about.
Yeah.
Which leads me to the other part of my question that pops up throughout. It seems like it's fairly consistent. The director shall determine. There's a lot of that language in there. Mm-hmm. And every time I read that, I think, wonderful, finally we can get things done quickly. But at the same time, that puts a lot of onus on the city to be sure we're right. Because if you go out and say, I don't see any endangered species, for example, and there are endangered species, the city's on the hook for that determination, right? Mm-hmm. So, in some form.
Mm-hmm. What it's giving us is the latitude to if it's something super simple and it's, let's say, because in theory everything would have to go through this. So say you want to develop two lots. It's already developed, and you can pretty much assess that anything they're going to do is going to help the habitat because it's either 100% paved at this point. So there could be some avenues, but 9 times out of 10, or pretty much 10 out of 10, in those scenarios, we're relying on it. Expert to help us assess whether these are necessary, and we're not just because we're professional planners.
Sure.
We don't have the science. We rely on professionals.
Yeah, I'm never questioning the judgment. Yeah. I'm only thinking ahead years down the road. And who knows who may be driving the train? They make a decision like that just because it says they can.
Mm-hmm.
I'm just putting it out there. I don't want to change anything. Just mentioning that. And then on the first page, I read no habitat
degradation from increased water temperatures. This is in the second, basically second paragraph. And it struck me as, okay, so glacial temperature, the origin of most of the water, it's getting warm every foot. How does anybody measure whether some particular project is causing a change in the temperature? How does that conversation even get going?
I think the temperature occurred below the waste treatment plant, and it was discharging warm water during the summer months, and it was causing warm areas in the water, which created algae and caused some trouble for the cold water fish.
Right.
What that's about.
Well, that, and I mean, even right now, whenever we catch storm water, hold storm water, and then pump it back into the system, it's engineered in a way that in theory, and not so much in the past, but now, that it wouldn't warm through the process. And actually, with our low-impact development street standards, it's kind of nice because it's point source infiltration versus ponding and piping.
And what I say, it was years ago, I think 2006 or something.
Yeah.
There wasn't anything recent.
Right.
So there, it's just basically, I mean, it's all part of the environmental review to show that you're not actually impacting your area.
So if it were industrial use, you know, out in the zones that allow that, you know, are you discharging, you know, what are you doing, and this is what you can't do, this is how you have to mitigate, you know. We've got to all be reviewed at the project level, but...
It just struck me because that's in this initial paragraph almost, and it's something that we have a goal about. And I think, you know, winter water temperature, summer water temperature, because the level in the rivers is...
And that's all taken into consideration.
How do you measure that?
And then you bring two scientists in and don't agree.
Yeah.
And
but
it's evaluated.
The Department of Ecology does tests up and down the river, too, so they'll know the difference.
That's who did the wastewater and the HTM.
Question mark. And in the highlight area, number page 14.
What's the number at the top?
1412.5050. At the end of the second sentence, I wonder if we could insert language that says, if required.
Read the sentence you're speaking to.
Given the highlight at the bottom of the page,
mm-hmm.
It's referencing, where we go, it's the tail end of 1412.020, and item B, a floodplain habitat assessment. A mitigation plan may be required unless the CED director makes documents a determination of no adverse effect on any species listed under the Endangered Species Act. And then starts again, the habitat assessment. I'm just wondering if there's some kind of requirement that needs to happen before that starts. Am I making sense?
Well, it says may be required unless... So if it's determined there is one required, the second sentence describes that.
Okay.
Third. If required, the habitat assessment. Does it say that?
That's kind of where I was headed.
Okay.
Just kind of.
If required, the habitat. Okay.
And then further down, three lines down, the word draft is used. Is that a formal term that's the best that's available, or is there going to be a final non-draft?
Or any successor guidance document approved by FEMA for habitat assessment and mitigation. That's
your question. Is draft part of the name
yes.
of the actual document?
This is going to be our language.
Yeah,
it's going to go past the point where I hope that's no longer a draft.
Yeah.
That's my point.
They never do.
This one.
It's, it's penny ante stuff. I just caught my
no,
attention and throw it
good
out
point.
There.
Yeah.
I think that's why they've inserted an or and successor guidance document.
Yeah. All right,
it'll be outdated by the time we
enact
it.
And we'll take more time on that. Then I'm down at the second to last line, which begins the middle of the page, non-development.
I'm sorry, I'm going to go back to the very first sentence and where you just were.
Yeah.
And I get that the part about the director may say no, don't need one. But the first word, the operative word may, well, if you don't give them the pass, then what is determining the may?
Yeah, so it should say shall be required unless, is that what you mean?
Well, that's my question. Is it may be required? Who would determine whether or not it is required if not the director? If the director says, I'm good.
I noticed that too. I think it should be shall.
Right now, you have to choose door B. And FEMA says, if you don't prepare all these amendments, you have to do this assessment.
Okay, so FEMA then is the. So if the director doesn't, that's the other controlling body, is what you're saying. Is FEMA may still say, yes, you do, or no, you don't.
They'd have to appeal it, probably, similar to the shoreline and ecology. We still have the authority to approve a shoreline permit. They can always say, no, we don't like what you did, but based on their involvement on this project, they're going to be reviewing all
the
projects.
We're so up to date. However, we have had a little different correspondence with FEMA recently on this. Is basically had three options, and this option was the best. I mean, they have a model ordinance which is so restrictive. And then there's this middle ground, or it's a case by case. Well, we've been doing case by case, which is what the hotel's under. The problem with case by case is it's just not streamlined. So what we're trying to do is streamline it. So in the end, it is required how it's going to evolve. So I think to simplify, a shall is.
You know how I feel about shalls, but in this case, I have a feeling that shall is the right word.
Yeah. I like should better.
Yeah.
Generally, I do. But this seems to leave no equivocation. You either will or you won't.
Yeah. I'm going to bring that up again in a minute.
I know. Thank you.
And I know FEMA, we've had FEMA ask us about one. So they are tracking.
Wouldn't they be more inclined to like the shell in this instance?
They would definitely like the shell.
I can see the bumper sticker. Behold the shell. Are you wrapped up on that? Okay. So I'm at almost the bottom of the page, in the middle of it, second line up, where it begins, non-development activities, and ends on the next page with the words mitigation consideration. I read that twice, and I thought, well, no kidding. I want to kind of state the obvious.
It's basically saying there are exemptions to this.
Okay.
Yeah, it does seem like one of those you actually need to make the statement.
Yeah. Okay.
If it helps clarify, I guess that would be the benefit, but
this is one of those moments where if the question comes up and you say, well, it doesn't really say it's exempt, or you could actually say, oh, you got to do a habitat assessment. So this at least.
Fair enough. And then on to the next page, bottom number is 14. And there we'll go back to the.
It says shall before.
Should.
I saw that. There you go. And yes, there you have it.
For what it's worth,
encourage
shall, shall is a crystal clear, no gray area. But should. Is a little less stretchy.
But in this,
may is off in the wild blue.
In this instance, what we're trying to do is encourage. This is encourage language. It's not a requirement language.
Okay.
That's the way I read it.
I'm just going to let it go. Somebody else wants to type up on that. Pardon me as I yell through these things on the other side. Covered that one already. Now I'm on the headings 18.06, 0.030, and the bottom number is 18.12. And I read through this because this is a lot of language about, you know, what's a battery of vehicle, what's neighborhood electric vehicle. Somebody's done this, I'm sure, there's a better way, by some grant for some university, some department. Exactly. So I'm on, looks like number 3, almost to the bottom of the page, under neighborhood electric vehicle. And it occurred to me, because they mentioned specifically four-wheeled vehicles, does that preclude a three-wheel golf cart?
Are there three-wheel golf carts?
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. Old school.
I don't know. You see, those are not, those are definitions that were provided from the state for the model electric vehicle ordinance that we addressed about a year ago. And that was, I think the intent of all of that was just to make sure there was consistent terminology used through the state so that when jurisdictions either permit or don't permit electric charging stations and so forth, and it's understood region-wide what everybody's talking about.
We could get rid of the wheels.
Seems like, yeah, why does it matter how many wheels?
Yeah, I mean, it's 25-mile
or
five-mile
scooter. If it's a scooter or if it's a three, because there are three-wheel
motorized unicycle. Mr. Tepler, I'm sure, is creating one.
It's under medium speed electric vehicle, too.
It's actually a single wheel.
Or we can check in the...
It does Mach 2.
It is, I guess the only question would be if it was trying to actually create a classification for a certain type of motor vehicle versus other types. But
that just caught my attention. This neighborhood mentioned the speed of 25 miles an hour is mentioned. I mean, that's as simple as it gets.
Yeah.
Are you up to 1811? I just have a quick question on the, it's 1811 in the red text, and we have mining in there, and it's talking about cottage housing, and I'm not sure if this is to be an exclusion or permitted under development means, and it's on the second line in red.
Okay, 1806. So what was the question?
I'm not sure. Does that mean we permit mining on these lots, or is that saying...
No, mining is...
it just means that mining is development.
Is development.
That triggers the requirement.
We don't allow any mining that I... remember in our permitted uses table, that's where it would be.
This is a typical catch-all.
Gotcha. Yeah. This is defined. I got it.
This is not a crazy question. Does water ever qualify as something mined?
I wouldn't think so. It's withdrawn.
Warehouser's got mining rights all over the planet, so I'm just thinking ahead.
I guess on a legal standpoint, you separate water rights from mining rights, but in a practical sense, I kind of agree. We are mining for water.
I'm sure warehouser somewhere.
Sorry, you see how my head works? It's just out there somewhere.
It's still right there. I can see it.
Fucking rain needs more.
And I've skipped a few pages here. 16-7 is the bottom. It's on the left hand turn of the page. Put it back in the package.
I'm sorry, Jim. Did you say you jump past the table to?
Yes.
Yeah. Okay.
Towards it. And I apologize. I can go back. I was just flipping to my comment.
No.
Somebody has something before that.
Okay.
So.
Yes.
Yes.
No.
Shall I continue?
No. Yes. You're on. You're on.
You're on a roll, man. Go.
You better said shall just now. So the top of the page says 16.08.
Yeah.
And I'm just, it's the word trailer has been deleted, and I'm wondering what, not that that's good or bad, I'm just seeing that that was a lot of energy.
Mm-hmm. That's fun, this chapter.
Because
it's not called a trailer anymore, it's a mobile.
Yeah, just the idea is consistent terminology. The chapter previously kind of referred to as trailers and mobile homes and there was a number of terminology in there, and all trying to refer to the same thing, so we're just trying to make it consistent.
Because a trailer and a mobile home are two very different things.
And match our definitions.
There's a technical foundation piece of that, tie down to, right?
Mm-hmm.
So I guess I'm just thinking, if there's someone who was qualified for something and they were a trailer living in a certain place, now if we change the language, they're no longer fitting that category. That's the piece that got my attention.
Mm-hmm.
And then now I also have to go check on everybody. That's a big deal.
And again, it's going to be new.
Where are the definitions? Is this for mobile homes?
The definitions are in this thing that we have a definition sections for our zoning code, and it does give a definition of a mobile home.
It's on page 16
of a trailer.
Okay, so we have no definition of trailer. So is this saying, to Jim's point, is this then saying that all would be classified as, for our purposes, as mobile homes? Anything that it can be lifted and moved?
We have also manufactured home and designated manufactured home, which are industry terms.
The definitions are a few pages ahead. On 16.4, they start before that, but 16.4, 16.5, we define the recreational vehicle, the mobile home.
And then the other piece that came to mind, a bigger point, a more philosophical, is as we go through all these changes, again, big picture, it seems like there's certain categories of land ownership where it's probably proper for us to actually give the relevant parties, the owners of that kind of property, a specific heads up beyond, oh, by the way, we put it in the paper a month ago and you didn't know about the meeting. So using this mobile home scenario, if somebody owned a mobile home and the lot it sat on, and we had a change in the code that was going to affect the entire mobile home park, everybody in that park should get some kind of specific notice that this is in the works.
And correct me if I'm wrong, because you guys worked on that. We aren't changing any rings.
Yeah, and again, made me think of this.
But philosophically, I understand.
And I just throw it out now because all we're doing is we're changing some things. We have no idea really what the specific change is going to be to any individual.
Mm-hmm.
So I know we've got some public notice requirements and some guidelines,
mm-hmm.
but I guess I'm saying maybe I'm encouraging in certain circumstances that we go to the extra step.
I think in my head, I get the philosophy and idea. Particularly, I like the example where you're saying it's a very limited use within the community.
Yeah.
It affects only a small number of people. But the extra point is that other changes that we make that basically apply across the entire city, or at least extremely large sections thereof,
yeah.
If you're looking to ask the city to take on the burden of mailing a letter, for instance, to every homeowner, landowner, you know, that's in a sense, that's defeating the whole point of public notice and the paper.
Uh-huh.
I mean, that is partially why that's there, is to say, hey, something's changing, and pay attention. I'm not sure. I get where you're going.
I don't know an easy fix to it. I think I'll probably bring it up again.
Because
I see that from the citizen's perspective, and sure, they can sit and think for a minute and blame themselves because they're not paying attention, but the reality is you have to be looking for a lot of stuff. You have to go looking for it.
Yeah.
And
you need to be looking at the right time.
I think often for me, it's even when you're reading it, though, because we state things in certain legalistic language, you can read it and you've got no clue that that applies to you.
Yeah. For the resolution of this issue, though, since we are changing the word trailer and implementing mobile home, you could just add to the definition, this includes a trailer. Because there, and then that would, or in some way, shape, or form, including using the word trailer in the definition, and then you're all encompassing. If there was somebody that felt that they had a trailer and not a mobile home, you know, if that's your concern, then it's exactly the same. It's just also getting to the consistency standpoint of the building.
Well, I guess where I was going with the first part of the question was if there was a different definition for what a trailer is than what a mobile home was. I couldn't off the top of my head think of one.
The one that I think of is it involves tie-downs. And it doesn't mean it's no longer movable, but the process would require you to unhitch it from the land.
I guess what I was thinking from a legal standpoint, you can take a trailer, remove the wheels, put it on a foundation, and untitle it. Mm-hmm. It's no longer a vehicle. Mm-hmm. Now it's a home, but now it's no longer, it's not a trailer, it's not a mobile home. It's if it no longer has a title, then it's no longer considered a mobile vehicle. Right? So I'm not sure how that applies, the difference between it. Again, I don't know what it's... Mobile
home
seems
broad. There's industry terms for what a mobile home is, mm-hmm. what a manufactured home is, and what a recreational vehicle are.
Mm-hmm.
And trailer, I don't think there's an industry standard for that. So whatever it is, would fit into one of those three categories.
Mm-hmm.
So we just want to make sure what we're talking about isn't that kind of squishy. Well, what is this thing and how are we...
Right, I'm with you.
Unless you included trailer, the recreational vehicle, the word vehicle assumes almost an engine.
Mm-hmm.
You know, a trailer is a tow behind, typically. So we are defining trailer, and we don't include it in one of the definitions. Jim has a point. So I think we should probably, you know, because a mobile home, what you just described, where you would not necessarily be a trailer, and there are trailer houses that you purchase and could easily park on any lot and live out of.
Yeah.
So.
I guess a mobile home park, they all get there on wheels, right?
Trailer park.
Trailer park. We're not talking about a manufactured home that's brought in pieces and assembled, right? We're only talking about something that got there on wheels. So I'm not seeing, I mean, we're probably taking it too far. I'm not seeing a distinction between trailer and mobile home. I suppose to move us on from here, I'm not asking for any change, but maybe it's something that once we're done with it and this goes forward to council, you're just ensuring that there's not some definition of trailer out there that would have some impact.
I think that's a good check, yeah.
The definition is going to be crystal clear because all of those items get financing.
Mm-hmm.
Those things are, there's definitions. Crystal clear ones.
Yeah.
Banks would be more money on a gray area. I hope.
You actually got a really interesting thing, though, because in mobile home parks, you never see those trailers just parked in a slot. So those have specific season parks for their own. And so I do think we need to
separate
the trailer. Yeah.
So there's these new concept things that are like little cottage houses that are on trailers. But it's not an RV.
Mm-hmm.
And to me, it's not even really a mobile home.
Well, it's a shipping crate, almost, right? I mean, I don't mean that.
It's like little log cabins.
Yeah, they're literally like just kits.
They're like little kits that you can buy. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Metal roofs and like.
Because they manufacture off-site and they bring it in.
No. This is something that if you have a piece of property somewhere, you can buy this little house thing that's on a trailer and you can take it there and you can just leave it or...
It's under 300 square feet, I think, right?
It's teeny.
Yeah.
So it's all under the radar. There's an article almost like that.
Unless it has plumbing. So if it is a structure that you're going to live in, it would fit the manufacturer, it has to meet the manufactured housing standards, which ensures that for us as a city, since we're not inspecting it, we can permit it. If it's just a structure that has no plumbing and falls in that 200 square feet or less, you don't need a permit, you can...
Consider it a shed.
It's a mobile shed.
Yeah, the main thing with those is that they're super insulated and very small.
Yeah.
Your body heat warms them.
They're not intended to be, you know, you carry them from campground to campground. It's like a...
No, I think those are cool, by the way. The only thing I had on this, from this packet, and I'm on the larger sheet, and it's numbered at the bottom, number one, the way down there. Under the regulation column. And this is another one of those, I think you answered the question. In the middle of the paragraph, it references or alteration of natural site characteristics. Somebody tell me what a natural site characteristic is. Something
that's
not man-made? What? How do you define that?
A hill, or it could be a tree. Trees you're removing, changing.
It'd be changing grade, changing vegetation, changing anything.
What I'm getting at is this implies we're not talking about it unless you are changing a natural site characteristic.
Where it would probably come into play is if you had large trees that were providing canopy and shading for the river and you want to remove those, right? Because then you would be changing the river temperature and you'd be changing the site characteristics
Let me try it another way. When are you not changing natural site characteristics?
That's kind of the point.
Unless you're moving a car off.
And actually, even now when you read about development, we've had many of discussions internally that attorneys will argue that development is almost anything.
Yeah.
And then you'll have another one that says, no, you can accept this. But yeah, you're absolutely right. I mean, it's basically defining development as almost anything.
Where are these pages going in relationship to
others? This was just developed to submit to FEMA. Their biological opinion provisions were on the left. And
oh, right.
Just to show kind of, and it's just kind of to encapsulate what we've done in all these pages that are part of.
Yeah, that's right. Okay, now I'm back on track. Okay. So what we've done essentially in addressing this is beefed up the definition of development.
And that's, again, that comes back to, you know, when you look at the code holistically, that comes back to, you beefed up the definition of development, and then you're going to rely on your exemptions, which every time you get a land use application, and first thing you do is you go through the list of exempted uses, and if it fits, great. If it doesn't, you know.
Here's our definition of development. I don't think it includes reference to changing of the natural. Is it?
Was on 18.
1405.200 is the top page number.
Maybe third page in or something?
Yeah. Third page in? 1405.
It is the last 4 or 5 cents of the paragraph.
Yeah,
Somewhere I've been reading development and change are synonymous.
Mm. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So they're pretty much covered.
But really, we're not making it any more stringent than what we previously had. If you look at what was crossed off, it said means any man-made change to improve your unimproved real estate. So that, by itself, encompasses just about anything.
So the guy cutting his grass is an actual developer.
Okay. We're not going to go there.
Well, he was following the exemption list. Yeah, of clearing and grading. He's not clearing enough.
Yeah.
Well, darn you, Jim, you got me hung up on that alteration.
I don't like
I mean, the literal interpretation is just way too broad.
But that's where you go to your exemptions. Because, for example,
yeah,
somebody comes
in
and says
that
they want to clear and grade, you know, dig a ditch, plant a garden. They're going to fall on the exemptions of clear and grading or fill.
They're doing a restoration project.
That's exempt. Maintenance.
So, I mean, anything. I mean, whether it's, if they wanted to build a shed, they'd be exempt under the 200 square feet. So, like, that's why, I think Mike and I said the same thing. In the end, development before was anything, and we've had those discussions internally with our legals people. And it's still this. The only real true change is the 5% mm-hmm. of the native vegetation, which could, in theory, change your clear and grading thresholds, exemption thresholds. Mm-hmm. Well, no, because this is just constituting development, yeah.
And that 5%, again, is in floodplains, mm-hmm. so it wouldn't trigger every clearing and grading permit, mm-hmm. just those in floodplains.
So if the lot is small, 5% is a pathway. Mm-hmm. A pedestrian path would trigger that.
But that's where if that's the case, and it's in a highly sensitive area, and you can mitigate your impact by using a different material, and it's cost-effective to do so, boom, approve.
I hate being with you on something. Well, it's literally, I don't have to do anything to it other than walk back and forth on the same location, the same line, over and over again, and I will have altered the natural.
Well, we can change it. We're just going by what FEMA asks us to do.
I know.
And it's neither, I guess the reality is it's neither here nor there. In the end, you're going to go to your code for that specific section, right. And they're either going to hit the thresholds or not.
Mm. You wouldn't trigger a permit by walking on your property.
No, so that's the thing.
If a floodplain permit isn't triggered, there's no habitat assessment required.
And if Mike said, if any man-made change
happens so rarely,
yeah. I mean,
unless your neighbor is a FEMA watchdog,
man-made change.
He's always worried about when we don't have the reasonable director in place. That's
yeah, I know. Yeah.
I don't know. Do you want to hand them out? After that discussion? Yeah, I saw you thinking. I just figured I'd verbalize it for you.
Well, we did.
We've caught a few things in our catch-all. I like that.
So if we have these sections open, it's just cleaner to
somehow address all of them. Either that or I have them collated and now I'm doing
you're one. Uncollating.
I'm uncollating and recollating.
Were you collating
perfect.
With your children?
All right. The first one is down towards the bottom, Q, binding site plan. We are changing that to a staff decision instead of a hearing examiner decision. And basically a binding site plan is site plan review for commercial development or subdivision of commercial land.
Vesting, same?
Vesting would be the same, yeah, at application.
Mm-hmm. So it's not defined by state law if it needs to be staff or hearing examiner. So we think it would just be simpler to
I like it.
Reduces cost and process.
Yes, I like that a lot.
Time, energy.
When have we used the hearing examiner in the past?
We haven't done a biting site plan for preliminary plats. We do. Yeah. Or a good example would be I think Mr. Worsh would have had a biting site plan, which was very insignificant. It would building in down, you know, in downtown.
You're talking about the yellow.
Or multiple commercial buildings in a lot. Sure, that's just a biting site plan.
But I'm used to the term vesting for some reason. That binding site plan. You're saying there's no difference.
The binding site plan is a land use permit that you get if you want to build a commercial development that includes more than one lot or building or what have you. Vesting is any application, whether it's a binding site plan, short plat, subdivision. The minute they submit their application and they get, you know, there's laws that we have to give a notice of incomplete or complete application within 21 days. As soon as that happens, they're vested, and that means the laws in place can't change either way. And that's the vesting word.
Is that true of the binding site plan?
Yes, it's true across all of those are the same.
Because I mean, that's hugely valuable for somebody who wants to plan, and they got to know what the rules are.
Yeah.
Spent a ton of money by that time. Already.
Okay.
Next one is so this is just a clarification on this is in our plat requirements. T had a approval and signature box, and it had the public works director, consulting engineer, which is sometimes the same person, sometimes not. But anyways, it didn't have CED director, even though we want a signature block for it. So it's something we kept having to go back. And because on U, which is crossed out, it says approval. Well, the approval is the signature block. So it's just to clarify that we want an approval block from those department heads.
Okay.
And then why do we do the consulting engineer on top of the public works director? Because the public works may not be an engineer you want to
Well,
your
then
sign
because
on.
The engineer is sometimes reviewing, if we have them on contract, they're reviewing all the engineering aspects of the project. Public works director may not have done that level of detailed review. So,
well, I understand, but from a represents the city standpoint, they still report to the public works director.
Truthfully,
right?
We would never have a consulting engineer sign. We would have a consulting engineer give us a letter that says, yes, I've reviewed it, and I recommend approval.
Right. If public works director signs it.
The only thing that I don't have an answer for, maybe you do, Jamie, but if for some reason the state law requires that an engineer actually sign it, and we don't have one on staff, that might be why that's there.
Right.
We could confirm that.
And that would, and therefore, the if applicable makes sense. But I guess my question is you wouldn't necessarily have we could have a signature block with only the public works director. Mm-hmm. You would only add for the consulting engineer if that were the requirement.
Yeah, it says if applicable.
Right.
We could say. Why don't we confirm whether it's necessary?
Because it makes sense to me what you're saying.
Yeah.
And I'm just in the idea of simplification and trotting things around for signature.
Mm-hmm.
If
you could say
got the letter.
Works director in the parentheses and consulting engineer.
I think we could just get rid of the consulting engineer because I really highly doubt.
Or what if it was consulting engineer if required?
Mm-hmm. Why don't we say or engineer if required? Because why do we care if it's a consulting engineer?
That's for sure. Right.
Yeah.
Oh, right.
And what's the back piece of this? That this is, you're creating a form, right?
Yeah.
It's telling the applicant what they need to have on the paperwork.
Usually for a recording of a plot or something like that.
Okay.
That's
good.
Who
brought that up?
Good. And then the last one.
Extras.
our subdivision right now, as you can see, is four or fewer lots. State law now allows you to increase that to nine, and really the difference is that you don't have a hearing examiner hearing. The review and the regulations are pretty much are similar for, you know, level of review, and our standards are the same. Unless it's, there's a few things where if it's two homes, or I guess it's three or less, you can do a shared driveway. You know, but
well, this again is just giving more discretion.
More flexibility.
To the city.
It gives us more flexibility and easier processing for the applicant, less cost for the applicant.
Well, what we're also finding is because of all our little lots, like Silver Creek, will all be about four, five, six lot mom and pops.
Right.
And the cost between a subdivision and a short plat really is pretty significant because our hearing examiner really is a bare minimum $1,000. And that's not a lot, but it is a lot when you're just mom and pop doing that.
Yeah.
So this could be anywhere from nine down. We ended up choosing to propose the most.
Including nine.
Yeah.
My only question would be is have you scrubbed the rest of the code to make sure that where we're referencing short plats that we've got nine now referenced instead of four throughout?
I will double check that.
Because I'm sure we speak to that in many places.
Yeah. One place that it does affect the code is in short plats, we allow the minimum lot size. Mm-hmm. The minimum lot size of, maximum lot size?
Maximum.
Mm-hmm. The maximum lot size is 10,000 square feet. So we're trying
for
to densify the city.
For short plats?
No, for subdivisions. Short plats are exempt from that maximum. Because what was happening a lot of times is you could get a person that had not enough to create three, but could never create two under 10,000 either.
Right.
So, and then we're only creating four. So that's one just area that has a potential.
It could result in having more greater than 2,000 square foot lots.
Having more? Right.
I mean, in theory, somebody came in with 90,000 plus, they could develop nine of those, have 10,000 plus lots versus the subdivision and then densify it.
Or what you're even more saying is you could come in with
three,
five
four.
Lots, three lots.
Mm-hmm. Yes,
20,000.
That's a better way to do that, yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
Could become a concern for GMA, I guess.
But we have that section of the code open, too.
Yeah.
Well, and we...
It won't be probably an issue for GMA because we're still zoned at 40 is required. I don't feel like you have to regulate people to maximize their highest and best use. Usually they do that.
That's what they're generally under.
Yeah. But just to point that out, that is the one exemption in our.
So
it's still even at nine lots, though, you're not talking a terribly large piece of ground, so I'm fine.
Is there that many? I mean, I know in Snohomish County a few years ago, I think you could get under it. I want to say it was like 12, or was it nine even then? But they had all these 5 acre, we were processing like five or six a day, a week, of just these tons of tiny short plats.
Breaking into 5 acres.
And then it's like you go about there, and it was just like there's just all these tiny, I don't think it looks good at all, but there probably isn't that much room for that here.
Well, now, short plats still have to meet our street standards, connectivity. So what was the difference rather than just the way they cut it up was they probably weren't required to.
Because they're all these just little bowl size, basically,
and that's
Yeah, we do require connectivity to adjacent parcels.
Even short.
Even for something that small, okay.
Yeah.
So then lot size, how does that take into account the roadway? Like, if you have nine lots, and you know, like you said, you had 90,000, can you really do nine? Because
well, you're required under our code to do a public street if you're more than just four homes. Mm. So
then the actual lot needs to be 10,000.
Yes, it's just the lot we're measuring for that, 5 to 10.
It's not like roadway center.
No.
Okay. So is there a disconnect between short subdivision and subdivision?
Yes.
Subdivision wording says land five or more lots.
Oh, yes.
Oh.
So it'd be.
You could Jim read.
Okay.
That's the only thing I read all night. Next
we time. Just take this one before we came. So. This one because we wanted.
That would end it up a little weird.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So yeah, I did plan to go through the code and check that reference to the four. And I guess I'll do it for this too.
I always heard the term long plat, but there really is no such thing as a long plat. It's just a subdivision, right?
There's that term is still used, I guess.
But it's just to say that you're not doing a short one, I guess.
Yeah.
It's still a subdivision. And then, I'm sure it's probably on another page, but boundary line adjustment.
Mm-hmm.
4 years old.
Mm-hmm.
Everybody feel okay?
Is it?
Fire truck?
Oh.
Kabang.
That was it for the new updates.
Your turn.
No, I'm going to let you wrap it up since you're late.
No.
Is there anything else for the good of the order? Time is now 8:25.
I guess.
We're not.
Yes. So, yes.
Oh, do we need a motion to approve the?
I was gonna say you're looking to.
Are we there?
You're looking for an approval if there's no other comments there.
Ladies and gentlemen.
So moved.
Yeah.
Second. I believe the motion on the table is to approve the.
As amended.
What are we calling this? Excuse me. Yes. Item number 5 on the agenda, the bylaws and pending amendments to the North Bend Municipal Code. We are approving that as written,
as
changes that we've discussed tonight. Is there a second to that motion?
Second.
Thank you.
Discussion? Objections? Hearing none. The motion passes. Good. Everybody happy?
Happy.
Can we hear another motion? Get out of here.
Adjourn.
To adjourn.
I beat you.
We're adjourned.
I know.
So,